Aloha. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. This is Catherine Cruz. It is Wednesday, August 14th. Today we consider the life cycle of a solar panel. What happens to the hundreds of thousands of them across the state when they stop working? It's a photovoltaic problem we could see coming. This week marks the end of World War II, VJ Day, victory over Japan. Japan surrendered after the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Today, Japan is one of our closest allies. We bring you a story about the Battle of Guam that you don't hear much about. We hear about problems with a federal program designed to help with housing following the wildfire disaster. It's a Honolulu Civil Beat ProPublica piece that follows the money. And Man of La Mancha heads to Maui to dream the impossible dream. We hear from beloved singer Amy Hanalei Gilliam, who plays the role of Aldonza. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today marks a year since Inter-Island Solar Company began to get into recycling photovoltaic panels. HPR reporter Savannah Herrmann-Pote joins us to talk about the not-so-green side of solar energy. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, you know, these panels are large, and we don't have a lot of room in our landfill. So, yeah, it's a problem.
Yes, and that's something that at least one company is tackling, Inter Island Solar Supply, which operates across all the major islands. Just a year ago, actually, today, started recycling for customers on Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and Big Island. And I talked to Will Deasy, who's with Inter Island Solar Supply's parent company, and he said that when they first started offering the service, they thought that the demand would be pretty low.
We really just kind of wanted to offer this service as like a supplement to all the other stuff that we already have been doing really, really well for many decades, right? And we, you know, when I worked with our CEO, Brian Gold, to kind of figure this out, we kind of started this thinking, yeah, well, I don't know if we're going to make any money or if anybody's going to pay, you know, at the time it was $47 a module to recycle stuff. You know, we thought we'd maybe get, you know, 10 modules a month or something like that and just, you know, have it as a value add. We were wrong, very wrong, about who would be interested and how many modules we ended up getting. So clearly there was a huge need for it, and we were just very well positioned as a company to be able to do it.
So what kind of interest were we talking about here?
So Will said that Inter Island Solar has accepted in the last year thousands of solar modules for recycling, which was way, way, way beyond what they thought they'd get. And he's looking at all of this interest, and he thinks that this is probably just the start of a big, big boom in solar recycling.
Hawaii is unique in that it's one of the oldest solar economies in the United States. So before 2030, about over 100,000 individual systems in Hawaii will be over 10 years old, right? So you'll start to see decommissioning of those systems, you'll start to see repowering of those modules, and then you'll start to see, you know, takedowns, and then you have this waste issue. When we started it a year ago, I did not think that the volume of modules that we got would be as much as we ended up getting in the last year. So what I think is that there's this kind of iceberg of renewable energy material that could be recycled that otherwise isn't getting recycled because the focus is often on building the amount of generation, right? How do we get 5% to 10%? How do we get 10 to 20? How do we get 20 to 50, right? That is where the focus is at.
Yeah, and I remember asking, you know, from the get-go when they were talking about the solar energy, like, oh, what about the panels? You know, what about where are they going to end up when they get old?
Yeah, and so this has been a topic of conversation at the state and county level on how are we going to handle this, right? Because we have a relatively old solar market in Hawaii comparatively to other places in the U.S. And I spoke about this with Michael Cooney. He's a UH professor and he's with the Hawaii Natural Energy Institute. And he prepared a report for the legislature in 2022 on this issue of solar waste. And he's also been talking with the state in Honolulu County as an expert. And he says, right, we know what the solution is, right? We know that we can't have these solar panels going into landfills. So we need to create systems that incorporate recycling to make sure that we don't have solar panels piling up as they're decommissioned. But he's identified a couple of barriers that he's concerned about. A big one is cost, right? As Will said, it's currently $47 to recycle just one module. And so on a single family home, you might have anywhere between 10 to 20 modules. So that's $700 out of pocket for a homeowner. And also, while he really championed what Inner Island Solar Supply has been able to do over the last year, he thinks that entirely outsourcing the disposal of solar waste to the private sector isn't a good idea, because what if they decide to go out of business or decide it's no longer cost-effective to operate? That makes it really, really difficult for residents to dispose of solar panels legally, since dumping them in landfills is technically outlawed, according to Michael.
Theoretically, the individuals are going to have to pack them up and make their own arrangements with recipients, recyclers on the mainland, which means they got to find them, look them up, which they're not going to do, but that's what they'd have to do. And they'd have to ship it by Matson, just like anything else you want to ship. It's not normal to people to ship things to waste recyclers. That's just not something that's in people's mindset. So it's not particularly effective, no. So I think those materials, I think they just get boxed up and they get thrown out with everything else, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're talking about residential here, but, you know, there are also those huge utility-scale solar farms with, you know, hundreds of panels. And they probably have the more of the wherewithal, right, the deeper pockets to put them somewhere, ship them off, but not so much for the homeowner.
Yeah, actually, when I was on the phone with Michael, I was thinking back, because I know my dad had solar panels on his house that stopped working at some point when we were living there. And I was like, huh, I wonder whatever happened to those, because those were years before Inner Island Solar started to offer this service to its customers. And so Michael says these are the kind of questions that we need to answer in order to avoid a rise in illegal dumping of solar panels. And he wants to see the state support Inter Island Solar as they expand their operation, as well as establish a kind of stewardship program run by the state that can look at offsetting costs and also handling all of the logistics of this process.
And you shouldn't rely on just one company, but it's the start. The state can still do things to support them. They can give them tax credits. They can give them land to store the panels. They can help them out in various ways if they wanted to. At the moment, they're not. And so it's completely up to Inner Island Solar to do all the logistical management. But if you got started with them and bring them in as a model and incorporate them in any stewardship program that was developed, it's not like we're inventing anything here. These kind of programs exist for electronics and other waste streams. So it's not like anything new. We're just bringing in two new, you know, panels are just the new waste stream.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, when we were talking about, yeah, what happens to these things when they get old. And, you know, sadly, a lot of these manufacturers have gone out of business, right?
That's true. That is true. When I talked to Will DC, he said that Inter Island Solar has no plans to start curbing service. And they are seeing increased interest, not just in Hawaii, but also in other places in the Pacific that are facing kind of similar challenges that we are. And he really described it as part of their mission as a renewable energy company to, in his words, make sure that we're not leaving Hawaii worse than we found it. But right now, they really are offering this not just as a service to customers, but kind of with a service-minded orientation. And Michael Cooney wants just a little bit more infrastructure in place around this issue of solar waste.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what comes up at the legislature this session. I don't know if they've tried to set up, you know, programs in the past that maybe just didn't get, you know, the support at the time. But we're going to have to, you know, face the music here.
Certainly, certainly. Again, we are looking at, you know, hundreds of thousands of solar panels that will need to be decommissioned, or in addition to that, solar panels that have just been damaged or maybe not are not working that need some sort of end-of-life solution.
Yeah, well, we will keep our fingers crossed that they come up with some kind of framework and structure going forward. I believe Ashley Mizzou just did a story recently about how our landfill just got an extension right on the permit here on Oahu. But lots of counties are facing the same problem. We're running out of space.
Absolutely. So it's something to see whether or not the county or the state really steps in to provide a solution that works for everyone, the industry and the consumers.
All right. Thank you so much, Savannah. That was Savannah Harriman-Pote with a look at the reality of green energy, the need to recycle solar panels, a problem that many could see was coming.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Aloha, this is Bert Lum, host of Bite Marks Cafe. The show has moved to a new day and time, Fridays at 6:30 p.m. on HPR 1. Join us as we showcase the creativity and innovation in Hawaii's tech community. Download past episodes of Bite Marks Cafe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the free HBR app. Bite Marks Cafe, now on Fridays at 6:30 p.m. on HBR 1.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Telcom, now offering Fioptics Plus TV service statewide, giving neighbor island families a choice in TV providers. HawaiianTel.com/FiOpticsPlus.
Our next segment, we are transporting you to another place. Guam is where they say America's day begins. Full disclosure, it is my original home island. And this week marks the surrender of Japan following the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was called VJ Day, Victory Over Japan. And in 1941, Japan seized Guam from the U.S. and controlled it for nearly 3 years. The U.S. took it back on July 21st, 1944, Liberation Day. The military called it W Day. The 80th anniversary was celebrated this year, not just in Guam, but in communities from New Jersey to Indiana to California. You don't hear too much about this point in time, as the Guam attack originally took place the day after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. And while the 80th anniversary of D-Day grabbed international headlines, the smaller battle of Guam was overshadowed. I happened to be there in Guam this summer and thought the story was worth sharing. These days, the island is anxiously awaiting the return of Japanese tourists. They have forgiven what the Japanese Imperial Army did decades ago. Survivors have shared brutal stories about massacres and death marches. Our story begins in church. The choir sings a Chamorro hymn. Most islanders are Catholic. After all, Spanish explorers claimed and ruled Guam for 300 years. This afternoon service in the cathedral in the capital of Agana honored those who survived the Japanese occupation. No ifs and buts about it. Guam's history is deeply imprinted with mass and, well, the military, whether it be Spanish, the U.S., or the Japanese. The sermon that day was about forgiveness.
In our native language, to say thank you or to be appreciative of one, we say Sidzuus Maasi. As we gather today, I hope that we are mindful of that, which literally translates to be God's mercy or the mercy of God. Sidzuus Maasi. As we once again embark on this journey during this liberation celebration, we have a lot to be thankful for. Many of our people who have died, who have suffered during the war. Many of the men and women in the military services have given up their lives, and many today who continue to endure the atrocity and the trauma of the memories of the war. We are here today to say thank you to God and thank you to one another.
One of the survivors in attendance was 90-year-old Bernadita Perez, my aunt. She shared that one of the most brutal accounts was from a 12-year-old girl who survived a beheading by the Japanese. Beatrice Flores Emsley would tell her story to Congress. She heard the cries of 45 Chamorro boys and men who Japanese soldiers tied to trees and then cut their heads off. With a gash to her neck, she and a young man who was bayoneted 5 times crawled to a nearby house and hid in an outdoor Spanish oven. My aunt said that home was my grandfather's. The stories go on. Guam's governor, Lou Leon Guerrero, had a relative who was a medic who helped the many injured in the bloody battle. And the theme this year, Peace for Us Always, resonates loudly.
And may the words, Todo y tiempo y paz parejita, echo through the ages, a reminder of our commitment to peace today and always. Si Dios masi, and God bless Guam.
During Mass, I happened to notice that in the communion line that day was Admiral Sam Paparo, head of Indo-PACOM. I would learn later about his ties to this place. His grandfather was a Seabee, the construction arm of the Navy, who had served in Guam. In a ceremony that followed Mass later that evening, Paparo shared he grew up hearing stories of his grandfather's time there.
I was mesmerized by the beauty and the culture of this special place. The Lord works in mysterious ways. And here in this special place, I had the great honor today of visits all throughout the island. Naval Base Guam, Task Force Talon, the Theater High Altitude Defense Site, Camp Blas, Anderson Air Base.
Paparo talked of inspecting the buildup of the island. It controls about a fourth of Guam. It is soon to be home to thousands of Marines as the U.S. shuts down its base in Okinawa. It is also home to one of the most advanced anti-missile defense systems, Terminal High Altitude Aerial Defense, or THAAD.
The attack involved over 59,000 service members and lasted over 21 days through August 10th of 1944 at the cost of 3,000 U.S. service members killed, 6,000 wounded. And the attack was successful because of the close-knit integration of soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Coast Guardsmen fighting together.
Billions of federal dollars are being spent in Guam, and while there are fears about the island being the tip of the spear for the U.S. forces and a target, Paparo said this.
To defend Guam, to defend America, that this shall never, ever happen again. Some say that this is the forward edge of America, but it's not. This is not the forward edge of America. There is a defense in depth, U.S. 7th Fleet, forward of this place, defending. U.S. 5th Air Force, U.S. 7th Air Force, U.S. 8th Army is forward here. Guam will never, ever be exposed again. I bring a message of hope. I bring a message of steel. I bring a message of confidence that Guam will always be a priority. We have our best warfighters here defending because Guam is the homeland. Preventing conflict, deterring conflict is our highest duty. The theme of this year's liberation, peace for us always, as the governor has said, is so absolutely fitting. The joint force is committing to a lasting friendship, to family, and the defense of Guam so that future generations will never, ever have to endure the tragedy that the Mañana suffered 80 years ago. We have confidence, we have hope to uphold for peace for us always. Viva Guam, viva America. God bless Guam, God bless America. My thanks to all.
And like the perfectly timed bells of the cathedral, on cue the Marine Band chimes in, the pomp and circumstance that comes with military ceremonies. Patriotism and peace, whether at the podium or in the pews, the faithful want to believe Indo-PACOM's word is good, and they may pray it is. Sidzu Usmasi, that was part of a commemoration that took place to mark the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Guam from the Japanese during World War II. That battle again began on July 21st, 1944, and lasted until August 10th.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, Ohana, working to protect and manage Oahu's water resources since 1929, for fresh water now and for future generations. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
Ben Rosenberg used to live near a park where everyone let their dogs off leash, even though there were signs explicitly saying not to do so.
And as soon as a cop would drive by, like, everybody would find their dog, put him on leash, and scatter. I mean, it was just a wild experience.
The curious ways in which we respond to rules, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Maui.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today, we're putting on our shades and exploring our long summer days. From late June through September, the islands experience the longest days of the year. You may have learned in elementary school that it's the Earth tilt that causes the change in seasons. For places north of the equator, like Hawaii, summertime means that the northern hemisphere is tilted toward the sun. As a result, daylight lasts more than 12 hours simply because there is more land exposed to direct sunlight. That's the scientific answer. But throughout history and in cultures around the world, there are other explanations. For today's question, we delve into Hawaiian mythology. Can you name the demigod who, as legend has it, was responsible for the creation of the summer season? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
For the last several months, Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Nick Gruby has been working with ProPublica on an investigative story about Maui. Gruby is based in Washington, D.C., and has been taking a look at a program under FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. That's the focus of today's reality check. Nick Gruby joins us to talk about this. Good morning, Nick.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yes. So, you know, we've heard stories since the fire about, you know, problems that were happening there on the ground, but you actually took a deep dive and tried to follow the money and find a paper trail.
Yeah, that's right. So this story is about the people who were displaced by landlords on Maui who later rented their homes to FEMA or other aid programs that were offering really high prices to house wildfire survivors. And, you know, we've been hearing these stories for a long time, me and my colleagues, I'm sure others who've been covering the post-wildfire fallout have also heard them. And proving it, however, has proven a bit challenging. And that's where working with ProPublica and really spending some time to dive into this issue has really helped us start to get our arms around this issue. And so, you know, we've interviewed dozens of people, including tenants and landlords, and reviewed nearly 100 different court cases. And what we found is that, you know, this was actually happening. People were being pushed out, and in some cases, their landlords were later making more money by renting to wildfire survivors. For instance, we found a family of four that was evicted so that their landlord's son could move into their place while renting his own home to FEMA for $8,000 a month, which was more than four times the amount that family was paying in rent. In another case, the parents of twin boys were surprised when FEMA inspectors knocked on their door of the condo that they were living in to see if it was suitable to house wildfire survivors.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy because, you know, we heard officials warn people, hey, you know, this shouldn't be happening. You shouldn't be evicting folks just to try and make more money. But yeah, it's sadly it was happening.
That's right. And I think, you know, officials did have concerns that this was going to be happening once, you know, they started to operate this direct leasing program, which it's commonly referred to. And there were others who were sort of raising alarm bells, including housing advocates and tenants' rights lawyers, who were worried because, you know, FEMA and the state and some of these other programs were offering vacation rental rates to property owners to house wildfire survivors. There were also lucrative tax breaks that Maui County was offering. So there was a large incentive for people, financial incentive for people to participate in this program. And, you know, a lot of the folks who are being pushed out have been pushed out despite an emergency proclamation that was put into place by Hawaii Governor Josh Green and Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke after the fires to basically curb evictions and stop rental increases to halt the housing crisis that is ongoing there. But as the story that we published today notes, there are a lot of exceptions to the proclamation that still allow landlords to push people out.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking like $5,000 a month for a studio and up to $11,000 for a four-bedroom.
Yeah, and those are just the numbers that we know about. You know, we've talked to some landlords who are getting above more than $11,000 for a four-bedroom. We report on one individual in which a four-bedroom unit is going for $11,000. But, you know, FEMA has been reluctant to share how much money it's paying for its units, saying that each individual property must be negotiated on its own.
Yeah, some people, I'm sure, who maybe were affected were maybe, I don't know, either too scared to complain or they might have just left the island.
So that's a real challenge. You know, throughout this process, I've talked to plenty of people who were afraid of speaking out. You know, they didn't want to upset their landlord if they were currently in a beef with somebody that had control over where they were living currently. Some of them just didn't want to rock the boat. You know, they just wanted to move on. Now, other people just up and left, and they left Maui altogether. And, you know, I think that's a real risk for a lot of people moving forward. And, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do at Civil Beat and with ProPublica is we're trying to find more people to come forward with their stories. And we've actually put out a survey today with the story that we published, asking people to tell us their stories. And we want to hear from tenants. We want to hear from landlords. We want to hear from the property managers working for FEMA. We also want to hear from government officials. And so, you know, I'm hoping we can get as many people as we can to participate in the survey. And, you know, we have a URL that people can go to, and it's propub.li/Maui Fires. And that's propub.li/Maui Fires. And we want people to go there and to tell us their stories, because those are the things that are going to inform our reporting moving forward.
Yeah, there needs to be definitely some follow-up. But we certainly appreciate your efforts, Nick. We'll look forward to more stories. But thanks so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Nick Gruby with today's reality check. Again, read that story at civilbeat.org. Do a little fill in the blanks. Well, white-tailed tropic birds are best known for their, you guessed it, white long tail feathers. They can be found throughout oceans in the tropics, and they are the subject of today's Manu Minute. We've got their calls thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
White-tailed tropic birds, or kua'e kea, are possibly the most distinctive seabirds we might commonly see on the main Hawaiian islands. Bright white with striking black bars across the top of their wings, they have two long streaming tail feathers that sets them apart from all other birds. These feathers are found on both males and females and are mostly used for displays, as they don't seem to help at all for flight. As their English name suggests, kua'e kea are found only in tropical oceans worldwide. The ones that live in Hawaii will often fly hundreds of miles out to sea to find food, and unlike other seabirds, prefer to mostly forage alone or in small groups. They're known for their spectacular plunge dives from high altitudes into the water to capture small fish and squid, and they can even catch flying fish in flight. Their calls have been described as harsh, raspy, and less than pleasant, though I'm not so sure I agree. But see what you think. On the main Hawaiian islands, kua'e kea are most often seen and heard as they gracefully soar near rocky cliff faces. They nest mostly in crevices and cavities in inaccessible cliffs or crater walls. Because of this, they're very hard to study, but we do know that they generally lay just a single egg each spring, following a brief but affectionate aerial courting display. And if nesting is successful, the chick leaves the nest and is on its own about 4 months later. The long tail feathers of kua'e kea have been used in featherwork in Hawaii and around the world. Their populations seem to be relatively stable, but they're very susceptible to increasing levels of marine plastic that's making its way into their food. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Biology Department.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, offering guided nature adventures on Hawaii Island, designed to help inspire connection and stewardship of the land. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
It's time to soak up the sun with our backyard quiz answer. Earlier, we asked which Hawaiian demigod was responsible for the creation of the summer season. According to legend, the goddess Hina was known for making fine kapa, but was often frustrated that her cloth couldn't dry due to the sun racing across the sky too quickly. So she came up with a plan to slow the sun down so her kapa could dry. She shared her plan with her demigod son, who enlisted the help of his brothers. The group then set out on a fishing trip of solar proportions. They went to the house of the sun, Haleakala, where they fashioned a noose and lay in wait. When the sun emerged and became fully entangled in the trap, Hina's son demanded the sun travel more slowly. When the sun refused, the brothers beat it up until they'd agreed to comply. Since then, the sun has spent more time in the Hawaiian sky every summer. So it was demigod Maui's love for his mother that explains why the days are longer. That is the answer to today's quiz. And Walter Rodby from Honolulu, you got it right. Got an idea for a quiz you want to share? Write to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Chances are you're probably familiar with our iconic local singer, Amy Hanalei Gilliam. The Nahoku Hanohano Award winner and Grammy nominee is Hawaii's top-selling female recording artist of all time. You may not know, she grew up performing for Maui Youth Theater and has a bachelor's degree in musical theater. Well, this weekend, she returns to the stage on Maui in a production of the musical A Man of La Mancha, based on the novel Don Quixote by Miguel Cervantes. She plays the role of Aldonza, the kitchen wench and part-time prostitute who becomes the love interest of the main character, Don Quixote. The conversation's Wasa Subiona recently talked with Gilliam about returning to her musical theater roots.
I read that director David C. Johnson has reimagined the production for this run in Maui. Can you talk a little bit about what makes this version unique?
This particular production at this point in time, you know, with our Lahaina fires and, you know, so much changing in Maui and, you know, a lot of people having a hard time. It really is a musical that's so poignant of this time period for hope and to dream that impossible dream. And, you know, the whole setting of the production is in a prison, in a dungeon in the 1500s. And there's a lot of mental health issues in a lot of the prisoners. And David is such an amazing director because each person in the dungeon, even though they may not have lines, they're part of the cast, they all have a backstory and they create a backstory for their characters. And it just is an amazing piece as well about mental health.
And you're playing the role of Aldonza. Can you talk about the role and what attracted you to it?
So I went to a musical theater school. I graduated from Baldwin High School here in Maui, and I had an amazing drama teacher, Miss Sue Ann Loudon, that really pushed me into going to school for it. And so I went to San Diego, and I played a lot of roles in San Diego because my parents, you know, didn't have a lot of money, and I said, I have to leave school, so unless you put me on full scholarship. And I was playing a lot of leads at the school, and Aldonza was one of them. It was an amazing school because equity actors would come down from Los Angeles. Like my Don Quixote then was an equity actor. So we'd learn from them. And I fell in love with the character then of Aldonza. I was a lot younger then. I understand her more now, you know, being a little bit more older and mature and, you know, having lived some time. So I understand her a lot different now. It's an amazing character. She's very complex. She's never seen the moon, never seen the sun. She was born in this dungeon. Her mother's name was Aldonza. And all she knows is this prison and the muleteers. And all she does is survive in this atmosphere.
What I love about the character so much is that she is looked down upon by those that are there in the dungeon, by society as a whole, until Don Quixote comes along and sees the lady in her. And it seems like an example of how a person can be transformed when just one person believes in them. Do you find that that's a theme that runs through the story, that is part of your character as well?
You know, absolutely. Miguel de Cervantes is actually the prisoner who plays Don Quixote. And Richard Cray and I, he's the Broadway actor that's playing him, he and I were having a talk that we really think that Miguel de Cervantes was in love with her and he chose to do Don Quixote to get closer to her. Because when you see in the play all of the stuff that he does, I mean, the connection I have with Don Quixote is very deep, very confusing, because here she is, this kitchen wench that has to sleep with everybody to survive. But she's a very integral part of the prison. You know, she keeps the pulse going in the prison and has been doing it for so long that she's just learned how to survive. Like her relationship with Pedro, which is another tumultuous, I love you, I hate you, I'm going to sleep with you, I like it, but I don't, you know, and then the whole abduction scene really just sends her into a tailspin. And so she's a very complex person.
Yeah, there's so much to her. There's this sadness and there's this longing that makes for a very interesting character. And when we look back over the history of Man of La Mancha, a few notable names have played Aldonza in the past Broadway productions. We've seen actress Mary Elizabeth Master Antonio mm-hmm. play her. We've seen pop singer Sheena Easton play her. Mm-hmm. Sophia Loren played the character in the 1972 yep. film. How are you putting your own mark on the character?
What I love about working with David Johnston is that he really helps you explore the vulnerable side of the character. Like when I do the Aldonza song after the abduction, you know, she's raped and all of this, and she's just had so much hope because she just was so hopeful with Don Quixote, and then the muleteers just break her down. And she comes out and does this song called Aldonza and explains who she is.
Won't you look at me, God, won't you look at me, look at the kitchen slaughtering of sweat, born on a dung heap to die on a dung heap, a strumpet men use and forget.
That part right there is kind of my pivotal moment in the musical where I'm very raw. And I think I play her a little different because I've been able to tap into that source of vulnerability, mental health, where she's just completely broken and just spills out all of her guts to Don Quixote. And he doesn't want to hear it, but she's making sure that he hears it. And so I think I brought a little different type of thing to the character in that sense. I've never really seen her played like that, where she's really kind of screaming the song to him. She's so frustrated.
Judging by your explanation of your character and the enthusiasm that you have for the character and for this play, it sounds like you really have a heart for musical theater. What is it mm-hmm. about musical theater in general that you're so passionate about?
You know, I've come to an understanding that I really miss it a lot because I tour so much being myself. You know, when I first started working with Willie Kay back in the day and we were touring, I had to step out of that realm of breaking the fourth wall. And that's the wall in between the character and the audience that you never break. And then suddenly I'm myself and I'm talking to the audience. It was very odd for me. I've played Hello Dolly. I've played Eva Perón, Katasha and the Mikado. I played a lot of very big women roles. And, you know, when I went to school and I was studying musical theater, the point of when you start singing is when the character can't express itself anymore. It just, the next level is to sing it. And it's a certain theory that I learned in school that has really helped me in my musical, not make it so kitschy and showgirly, kind of, you know, more like Anything Goes or anything like that. But on more of these media roles where you can't really do that, there has to be a progression of the character. And that is what that is. I can't say anymore. I just got to sing it to you kind of thing.
Having a degree in music theater and understanding your love for it, what kind of tipped you in the direction of becoming a music artist instead of maybe pursuing a career as an actress in musical theater?
Well, funny little story. So my school was really hard in San Diego. I had to audition every year to get back into school. And I was on full scholarship. We had to weigh in. We had to be a certain weight. Our artistic director was Jack Tygett, and he was very old school Hollywood. And that was just how it was done back in the day. So that's the way he was with us. I had an auditioning class where I had to go in every week audition for a character, sight read on the spot with a piano player. It was really, really a hard school. So when I broke out into the music scene, it was because I used to go up to LA and audition all the time. So Jamie Foxx is my classmate that went to school with me in San Diego. And I wanted to audition for the role of Les Mis. I wanted the role of Fantine. And so I told him, I said, hey, you got to come with me. And he's like, what? I'm like, you got to come with me. And he was so funny. He's like, are there any African-American people in that show? And I'm like, I don't know, but you're coming with me. I don't know if you ever seen in the auditions in LA, but it was right across the street from the Hollywood Bowl. It was that big white church. I knew that it was going to be packed because it was for the touring company and this and that. So I got us some cots. I got a little hibachi. I got Colby ribs and macaroni salad and rice. And he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, we're going to be here for a while. And he's like, what do you mean? I go, we're going to be, just trust me. My number was 7,392.
Oh my gosh.
Jamie's number was 7,393, right behind me. So he was so grateful that I brought all this food because we were camping for 3 days on the sidewalk, slowly moving up to finally get to the casting agent. Get to the casting agent, and I'm with my picture on my chest. He's next to me, and she just goes, next. She didn't even say anything. She just said, next. I couldn't open my mouth. Apparently, I was too tall. So I walked out, and I looked across the street at the Hollywood Bowl, and Natalie Cole was in concert, and big name in lights on the big neon marquee. I turned to Jamie and I go, his name back then was Eric Bishop. I turned to Eric and I go, it's got to get better than this. And then I looked across the street and I saw that. And I was like, that's what I'm going to do right there. It's exactly what I'm going to do. My own concerts. So that's where my mind kind of changed a little bit. I want to make a difference with my music and I don't want to get caught up in this whole Hollywood scene. And so I came home and then my grandmother was with us at that time, my Hawaiian grandmother, who is a whole nother story of just a pioneer out of everything Hawaii. I was sitting washing all of her albums with her teaching albums. So she was a kumuhula, and I was washing all of her albums and listening to the LPs with her. And then I, you know, kind of mimicking and have you ever thought about doing this? And I go, well, what? She's like singing Hawaiian music, like this Leo Haiai. And I said, I've never thought about it, but I'm pretty sure I could, but you know, I'd like to train a little bit. And so I went and sat with Auntie Genoa Keawe for a while, and I don't think she would have taken me under her wing if I wasn't disciplined, you know. So I took everything I learned in musical theater, everything I learned from the aunties, and I just applied it to what I do now. And in my compositions, I just apply everything that I've ever learned.
I would definitely love to see you in more musical theater after Man of La Mancha has run. Do you think that you'll be looking for other roles or do you kind of just take it on a case-by-case basis?
Yeah, possibly. You know, David Johnson, I worked with him, 4 years ago, I played Ava Perón at the MAC. I like roles that are challenging and time signatures are hard and there's a lot of 6-8 in this musical and, you know, just physically challenging as well. This go-around, oh, I'm all over that set and just stairs and the abduction scene, and it's just physically very, very demanding. And so I've decided that I want to do at least one musical theater show a year just because I miss it so much. You know, it's hard to explain to my fellow entertainers in Hawaii. They're like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm doing a musical. And they're like, why? I don't know how to explain it if you've never, I mean, it's like I hunger for it, you know?
Man from La Mancha runs Friday, August 16th through Sunday, August 18th, and Friday, August 23rd through Sunday, August 25th at Castle Theater at the MAC. Can you tell our listeners what they can expect from the production?
When you come, you're going to be so moved. The music is so beautiful. Richard Cray is from Broadway, who plays my Don Quixote. He's got such an incredible voice. My Sancho is a classmate of mine from way young Hanabata days, Francis Tau'a, and he's amazing. The cast is amazing. The voices are all just absolutely beautiful. And the staging that Andre Morissette has done is just phenomenal. Andre and David are known for these big productions. And, you know, I tell people from the Outer Islands, We have a matinee on Sundays. So if you want to come in for that show, you can always go back on the last flight if you want to just come over for a day of theater. But it's quite spectacular.
Amy, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate being able to talk to you.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
And that was local music artist Amy Hanaili'i Gilliam talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. Man of La Mancha opens this Friday at Castle Theater at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center. It will run this weekend and next. We'll have a link to more information on our website after the show. Well, we're out of time, so we have to go. But tomorrow, we plan to say goodbye to Petland, a small family business that is facing the reality of online shopping and big box competition. Leave your feedback on our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our shows as a podcast on Apple, Spotify, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation. Thank you.